International Broadcasting lives on 5085. The Big One, WTWW.
Please stand by as we get ready to launch another episode of this Reality Radio Cafe Cast with your host and my husband, Denny J, K5DCC.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition, liftoff.
Now grab your glass and get ready to fill it up with some radio on the rocks.
Vehicle's pitching downrange.
Here in the Digicom Cafe Communications Network, we are all about the power of voice. Did you know that you could listen to my Cafe Cast by simply asking Alexa to play Radio on the Rocks, and that you could maneuver your way around my Cafe Cast library by simply saying Next or Previous? I created this Amazon skill using a free and easy platform called VoiceFlow, where you just build your skill block by block, no coding necessary. If you'd like to build your amateur radio skill, go to voiceflow.com. That's voiceflow.com. WD9GET, K5DCC, Echo Mike 36. Hey, thanks for working me on the bird yesterday.
And K5DCC from WD9GET, Echo Lima 2-9er. Yeah, great to see you there. I'd love to get the QSL through LOTW for you, though.
Oh, no problem. I'm not a paper chaser, so it's not a big deal. I try and post them for everybody else, but I just love meeting people, and I've met so many interesting people on the satellite side of amateur radio, and when I logged them, I usually looked them up on QRZ like I did for you. Had no idea in the world who you were, a new call to me, and I thought, wow, this is impressive in his bio here on QRZ. So I couldn't help but send you an email and ask you to be my guest and hear your story. And as you know, what we do here in the cafe is feature hams of all ages from all over the world and get to know more about their story and how they got into this wonderful hobby.
Oh, very good. I got my start in ham radio back in the late 70s, and my brother is responsible for that. He didn't get his license till quite a bit ways after mine, but one day he came through the house and threw me a cassette tape and said, here, this will keep you busy for a while. So I put the tape on, and sure enough, it was, hello, I'm Wayne Green, W2NSD, and I'm here to teach you the International Morse Code. That, on top of my experience with the 4-H program, where I had done a lot of work in the electronics area and growing up on a farm, a lot of the livestock and farming aspects of it. But that gave me a lot of fodder for the electronics projects, especially in the years of Heathkit being a big dog at the time. And I made lots and lots and lots of Heathkits along the way, and including my Hot Water 101, the venerable HW101 transmitter that I've got sitting here in front of me in the shack, not operational, but it's great memories to see that rig and remember everything I did with that back in the day. Really, ham radio, I can't say it did much in directing my career path. I was interested in veterinary medicine, actually, from my farm background. And growing up in Indiana, I went to Purdue University and was in the animal science program. And during my early college years, I found an emergency medical technician course at the local hospital and signed up for it and took it and began getting more interested in the human side of medicine rather than the animal side. Finished up my bachelor's at Purdue and stayed on in a graduate program getting a master's in animal science in the area of physiology. And then got into med school at Indiana University in Indianapolis and stayed in that area for my residency in family medicine at Community Hospitals of Indianapolis. During that late med school and residency, I had joined the National Guard. My dad and brother were both in the military, did a stint in there, but not career, but I signed up for that as a part-timer, and one of the first things I did when I hit my residency program was got accepted into the U.S. Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine's flight surgeon program, which was a 6-week program down at Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio, which goes through all the aerospace physiology and the all the rules and regulations, the medical requirements for the pilots and anybody that flies in the aircraft. And that was fun. I enjoyed doing that on the weekend warrior basis. And after I finished residency, I went to a small private practice, group practice in Newcastle, Indiana, which was the area where I grew up. However, things weren't going too well in that practice. They were having some financial issues. I was on as a contract hire, and they said, well, you were the last guy we hired in, so you're going to be the first guy we have to let go. So I'd been enjoying thoroughly the aerospace medicine side of things as a part-timer, so I said, well, let's do that full-time. So as my wife says, September 1995, I ran away from home and joined the Air Force. Went to Dover, Delaware, spent a couple of years there, and then got accepted into the Air Force residency in aerospace medicine. And that's a 3-year program that included a Master of Public Health, a year of doing aerospace medicine, a year of doing preventive medicine. And from there, I went on and finished out a total federal military service time of about 28 years in the Air Force. And moved all around the U.S., never did any outside the U.S. type assignments. Those all made it rather difficult to do ham radio, because when you're moving around that much, it's hard to get a permanent installation. So for the most part, I had 100 watts and whatever kind of a wire I could string up and tune up somewhere. A lot of VHF, UHF. I enjoy public service. I really enjoy doing Skywarn, so I could get involved with those type of things as I went on. But one of the assignments that I had, and it's starting in 2004, is I got assigned to NASA's Johnson Space Center as the Air Force liaison to NASA. And that just rolled me in as another one of the flight surgeons down here doing space missions at the time. So shuttle is still going strong. I was deputy for the shuttle mission that took up the Kibo module, STS-124. And then I also did the STS-400, which is the mission probably nobody's heard of. That was the rescue mission for the Hubble, where they did the last Hubble repair. Yeah, they had to have two shuttles on the pad because we had to make sure if something happened that to that shuttle mission, we had a rescue going on. So I was the doc in charge of the medical side of the rescue mission, which made me a deputy basically for that Hubble repair mission. In fact, if you watch the IMAX Hubble repair video, I've got maybe a whole 5 seconds on the screen in that video. that's my claim to not so much fame. I managed to pull out 5 years, though, of that. I also did an ISS expedition, Expedition 13, with Jeff Williams. And that was my first contact with the space station, is a scheduled contact with my crew member during that mission. And then actually got a random contact in there with Bill MacArthur during that time, too. Just driving down the road, heard Bill come on and identify on the downlink on from the ISS, and worked him from the truck. So that was quite the surprise. Let's see. From there, I went back to the Air Force, had another 7.5 years to retirement. And when I retired, I came back to the Johnson Space Center. I'm down here as a contractor. Working what I did before, basically just working the space missions.
So you were in relationship with a lot of the astronauts and stuff then? You were like their doctor?
As flight surgeons, we worked very closely with the crew members. We're their personal physicians on one side. We're working anything medical that has to do with the mission. A lot of health and safety issues. A lot of it's paperwork and going to meetings. But we get to do a lot of the training activities. When I was active military, I could go flying with the crew members, and that was really great because the shuttle did a lot of the shuttle training aircraft, which had the small business jet that was mocked up to fly like the space shuttle. So I could go flying the T-38 out to El Paso, get in that aircraft, fly with them up to White Sands to shoot approaches out there, and then fly back. So that was some excellent time those days are kind of gone now with the cutback in the number of planes and pilots, and being on the contract side, they don't let us fly. Even the civil servants aren't getting to do much of that anymore, just with the conditions the way they are. But great way to get to know your crews. In the contract position I'm in, we also support crew training over in Russia. So Star City, the Gagarin, the Cosmonaut Training Center on the northeast side of Moscow is where they do all the training on the Russian part of the space station. So I spend typically 2-3 months a year in Russia supporting those training activities. And when we're over there, we're basically living full time with the astronauts, going attending the training activities during the day. At the night, we usually have a communal dinner and everybody gets together. Somebody cooks for everybody else, and we get to sit around the fire and have a cool beverage and just discuss whatever. So it's a great way to get to know our crews.
Very interesting. Well, talking about conditions, we're in some very interesting conditions now with COVID. Has that affected life on the NASA grounds there, working with astronauts and all the activities?
Yeah, we're NASA's Johnson Space Center, anyway, is pretty much shut down as far as people working on site. Mission Control has to keep going, but that's been pared down just the minimum number of people that have to be in there. I just completed working a mission. I was the lead crew surgeon for Jessica Meir that just got back. And, of course, that's when everything blew up, was during this mission. So we went from planning a very nominal landing program to having to come up with some very creative ideas on how to get to our crew members and how to get them back without getting any of us exposed to anything along the way. And it was really made difficult by having to deal with numerous governmental agencies from different countries and restrictions in getting in and out of all the countries that we needed to get in and out of. And we wound up having to take one of our NASA G5 business jets over and just go direct into Kazakhstan, which is something we typically don't do, and pick up our crew member and then fly directly back. And all the while trying to make sure everybody that had contact with the crew had been tested and quarantined and isolated and proper masking. And it was quite the interesting landing scenario, something we had never done before, and I hope we never have to do it again.
Wow. Well, being a doctor, what are your thoughts and insights on this COVID? How serious is it?
I wish I knew. It's been so politicized that the data is really getting heavily filtered as it comes out. Mm-hmm. A lot of the numbers that are being thrown out aren't being put in the proper perspective. I mean, I'm watching the numbers as they come out from numerous sites, but they don't have denominator data. They'll say how many people are positive, but we don't know how many people in the actual population that means. There's certainly been a lot of allegations that hospitals are better reimbursed if they have a COVID diagnosis, so that may be pushing over diagnosis. I'm not in that type of practice, so I have no idea if that's really happening or not, but you hear about it. So I just have a real strong question on if the data I'm seeing is actually really accurate or not. So on the good side, I think we're seeing, like down here in Texas, we've been opening things back up now for the last couple of weeks and have not seen any major increases in the number of cases we're seeing. I know there have been a few centers where that has been the opposite picture, where they've opened things up, people have gotten together and spread it even more. But again, is that a question of it actually spreading, or is that the way they're testing? There's just a lot of question marks on that. I don't think we're going to have the real answer on what happened and what we should have done for several years after we researched the data a little bit more and look at it with our 2020 hindsight.
Yep, and like you say, things are so politicized that everybody's afraid to say anything or take any stand on any side of the issue. But as far as the disease goes, it sounds to me like, and I'm not a doctor, but I'm hearing stories of people that have had it, and it sounds awful.
There are people that certainly are young, healthy, and in a matter of hours are on a ventilator and die. But I think probably that's the minority of cases. Those are the terrible ones, the ones we hate to hear about. and they're the ones that make the news. I think we have a lot higher percentage of people that get it and may not have any symptoms at all, or just a mild cold going on. So
sure,
I think it's probably more on that side, that it's a mild disease for the vast majority of people, but the few that it does attack, well, just like the flu, the few that it does attack really hard are in dire straits with it, and a good number of those have died. But
right. Yeah, like you say, you've got to put it in perspective with everything else. I mean, this is all we hear about, COVID. But mm-hmm. a lot of people die of a lot of other things, and we don't talk about that.
Yeah, and it shut down our medical system, so routine care is not getting done, and that's finally starting to open up. My wife got in for a more or less routine appointment today, so that's getting easier to do now. So, but we can't ignore the people with chronic illnesses, the screening for cancers, the things that we normally do to keep people healthy and take care of them that haven't been done over the past couple of months.
Yep, well, that's for sure. And the sad part now is that it sounds like a lot of family members can't even go in with their spouse for appointments anymore. And that
yeah, that's still true. I couldn't go with my wife today to her appointment. So
I hope
that's really bad. Parents can go in with kids, or at least one parent they'll let go. But that's been a real tragedy, because taking care of people is not just giving them the right pill or the right IV. It's also taking care of them mentally, spiritually, the whole body.
Exactly.
The whole person aspect.
Yeah. Well, getting back to amateur radio, the thought came to my mind was your involvement with NASA and space programs and things. Did that have anything to do with you getting into satellites and amateur radio?
I've kind of been a space geek since I was a little kid. So I think the satellite interest has always been there, but it's been rather of a taken a big station in the past to really get a usable satellite station. So I got my aero antenna sometime in early 2003 time frame, and that was probably my first contacts. But even then, it was a little bit more difficult. I think one of the first things I did satellite-wise was when Owen Garriott did his mission back in 1983. That was when I got real interested in trying to do tracking. At the time, it was my TRS-80 Model 1, getting the satellite tracking system up for that. We did try to work them from the club station at Purdue, and we really thought we heard them give our call sign coming back, buried in the noise, but we didn't make it on the logs, but we did get on the headlines of the school paper anyway for doing it. It's turned out not as good as we thought, but that was really a big boost to it. And I really didn't get my satellite system up and running till maybe 6 months or so ago, where I've got now the automated Yaesu rotor system, azimuth elevation, using SAP-PC-32 to track. And actually getting set up to where I've got a fairly decent station that I can work with the FM birds and the linear transponders.
You're way ahead of me. I don't know if I'll ever get into that linear stuff. I like to listen to it with my D74 or maybe on my IC746 Pro here in the vertical, but to actually get the whole system set up with all the antennas and rotors and computer control stuff, I don't know if I'll ever get into that. But you and I worked on a real easy one. I think it was AO92.
Yeah, we were on 92 yesterday. Looks like we've got PO101 up right now. I hear my rotor clicking on it anyway.
That's right. Yours is all automated, isn't it?
Yeah, so that I'll set it up for a satellite, and then when I hear the rotor clicking, that's my cue to start paying attention to it. And actually, the PO101... Yeah, it's coming up here in 17 minutes. I listened to that one yesterday, and I had not worked that one before. And it sounded beautiful. It was hardly anybody on it, so right. You could work very easily. And unfortunately, the FM birds are getting to the point now where if you've just got the handheld antenna and 5 watts, it's next to impossible to get in just because of the number of people. It's a major DX pileup on every pass. And with people being home, not at work, they've got a lot more access to going out and doing satellite contacts. So pretty much every satellite contact sounds like a weekend pass.
Exactly. Well, that's what I started out with, was just AO91 and 92. I had no luck with SO50. When PO101 opened up, that quickly became my favorite. Not very crowded. It does take a little bit more power to get into it good, but the audio is excellent. What's your favorite birds?
Yeah, I would try to get PO. The problem with PO101 yesterday is I didn't have the PL set up right, and the TS2000, which is the rig I use for the satellite work, is weird on the way the PL works for it. And the documentation on SatPC32, it says the last digit is needed by the TS2000. It doesn't tell you what digit to put in there. It took me a while. I figured it out. And then the only pass I've had since then was at 2 in the morning, so I didn't get up to try to do that one. I have found the Chinese linear satellites seem to be the easier ones to work. I like the linears because they're not as crowded, and it's a little more difficult to find yourself on it. But once you don't have that DX pileup type of feel, you can get a little bit more of a relaxed QSO on there. You can do the quick one if you need to, but you don't feel as rushed as you do on the FM satellites.
So that's the XWCAS?
The XW series, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. Those seem to be really good satellites, easy to get into, and very workable birds. And there's they're kind of clustered in orbit, so you can go from one to the other.
Yep. Do you find that the VHF downlink is a lot better than the UHF downlink?
I don't seem to see a lot of difference.
You
I can go either way, and it's really, in a lot of ways, transparent to me because everything's programmed in.
Mm-hmm.
I say, go to that satellite, and I work it. I don't pay a lot of attention to which is the uplink, which is the downlink,
right. Because
my computer's taking care of the Doppler. The pointing's taken care of automatically. I just work it, so I can concentrate more on the operating
right. And
less on the details. But I've had good luck with either way, whether it's a VHF up or UHF up, either one.
Well, probably because your antennas are a little bit better than just an arrow, aren't they?
Yeah, I've got a 2-meter 11 element that I'm using, vertical polarized. And then my 440 is also an 11 element that was a homebrew antenna that I built specifically for this. So it's fairly narrow in its bandwidth, but it seems to do a good job on the satellites.
Yeah. So is your system kind of a circularly polarized array?
No, it's strictly vertical, and that it's getting a lot of fading with it. You've got to wait till the fade goes away,
right. And
as soon as signals start coming up, then you can really start trying to get in and work people.
I suppose
but,
you could
you
get
just gotta
the rotors
be patient
for that
for
too,
fades.
Couldn't you?
It's not for the circular polarization. It's more of a phasing. I'd have to do crossed elements,
okay. And
then a phasing harness on them, and then if you want to go right hand versus left hand, switch them back and forth, then there's another set of phasing harnesses and a switch you'd have to work into it. And I most people say it's really not worth that effort.
Right. Well, it's a lot of money too.
Yeah. Yeah. Not as much as the initial investment of getting the rotor and everything set up, but
right. Another
run of coax and remote switching system.
A lot of people don't know much about this, have no idea what it costs. So if someone wanted to get set up for linears with the rotors and the different antennas and everything, what's a typical ballpark investment you'd have to make, along with the radio and the computer controller?
Yeah.
And all that?
Yeah, the radio, of course, the TS2000 was one of the older go-to radios. And that's why I bought it 10 years or so ago, is because I really wanted to get the satellite system set up, but it took me that long to actually get it going. Now I think I'd go with the IC9700 on the radio side of it. It was designed with the satellites in mind, and it's usable with the controller software. The rotor's a pretty good chunk. That's usually gonna, if you buy them new, it's in the, I believe, the $750 range for the Yaesu's. And then of course you can go up from there. If you go to the Alpha Spids, those are going to be quite a bit more expensive. There's a system from Satnogs that you can 3D print some of the components. That's a lot less expensive, but it's also not as durable. So mounting it outside in all weather conditions and any kind of heavyweight antennas is probably not going to fly much. So there's another almost $1,000 you're going to have to put in that. The antennas, if you're an AMSAT member, they've got a little bit of a discount on the M-squared antennas that you can get, but those are still few hundred dollars to get that system, or you can build your own. It didn't cost me that much to build that 440 antenna. So just like anything else, it's going to take an investment to get it going. You're talking probably a couple grand, $2,000 to $3,000 to get your satellite system up just as an isolated satellite radio.
Yeah, not to mention the radio itself, which I think the 9700 is what, 3,000 or something? Or?
Oh, no, it's 1,500.
Oh, it's down. Okay, good. Well, yeah, you know, yeah. People that aren't hams, they look at us and they they think we're nuts. Why would you want to do that and spend that much money just to exchange a call sign and a grid square? But they don't understand. There's so much more behind amateur communications in space than what meets the eye. I mean, it's understanding the science behind it and knowing the distances and maybe chasing the paper, getting the awards. It's a fun hobby.
And there's so much you can do with it. If you get tired of doing one aspect of it, you can switch over and do something else.
Yeah. So what is your favorite mode of amateur radio?
Hard to say. I do operate quite a few things. I do a lot of just local FM work. I really like the public service aspect of it. So that's the most practical side, is just your standard 2-meter handheld is probably the one that I get the most mileage out of, though I'm also on HF daily. Mm-hmm. I check into the local traffic net every day. I am a Mars member, so I do Mars frequently. So I don't know that I can really say I have a favorite, but my most used modes would be VHF or UHF FM and sideband on the low bands.
Do you get into digital, DMR, D-Star? Fusion?
I do. Do you? I do. I am a big D-Star fan.
Okay.
I've had D-Star now for about 3 years, started out with the ICOM handheld, but picked up the Kenwood THD-74 when it came out.
Oh, you got those
and
too.
I absolutely love that radio. Oh, I love that radio. I had the older Kenwood THF-6A, and that was my workhorse radio, just that really small size tri-band, just loved it. And they've kind of done the same thing with the D-74, just add D-Star to it. Mm-hmm. I also have DMR because that's the popular mode in this area, so almost everybody's on DMR. So I do have an Anytone radio for that, and I just a few months ago picked up the Yaesu so I could experiment with Fusion, but after playing with them all, I think D-Star it's designed for ham radio. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually the easiest one. There are some quirks to it, like all of them, but I think it's really the easiest, most straightforward system to use. And I've really enjoyed it. I'm on 30 Charlie a lot, mostly listening, but that's where I hang out when I'm on my D-Star.
Yeah, it's either 1 Charlie or 30 Charlie for me, too, except lately I've been listening to 56B. I don't know if you've ever checked into the Kentucky D-Star net, but that's an excellent net. They usually get 80 or more. It's on a Thursday evening around 6 o'clock Central. But one of the SAT friends is Net Control and does a great job. So I also record those and share them here in my podcast as one of my reality radio episodes. But, well, go back to that D-74. I've only had mine now for a couple of months. I primarily got it because the ability to receive all this stuff, and then with this SD card in it, I can record very nicely without having to have all the wind noise and things. And there's so many features on this radio that I'm surprised the number of people that have them that don't use all these features, like, for example, the HF sideband stuff. Do you use yours for that much?
I have used it a little bit, but I don't use it a lot because I've got the HF rig sitting right here. I've got my ICOM 7610 sitting right here, so I don't typically use it for that. But it is an option, and with an external antenna, it works pretty well. I don't have as much luck with the built-in bar antenna on it.
Sure. Have you ever used it to receive linear satellites?
I have not. I've not tried it for satellite work because, again, I'm pretty well set up here. Yeah. At home with the big rig. The only thing I really can't do with the TS-2000 is SO-50 because of the birdie that's in the TS-2000.
Sure, sure. Well, I've been using
I've got the D71 I can hook up for that if I need to.
Sure.
Use our D72, Kenwood D72 if I need to do that.
And that's full duplex. That's probably the best thing to do for satellites, for portable.
That's my portable satellite rig.
Yeah. Well, I've been listening to the Linears using my D74. At first, I was frustrated because it's only 5 kilohertz step, and I thought, well, I have to wait for them to kind of slide into the right area. But then I found out there's a setting on there for fine-tuning, so I can go down to very, very small and just tune up and down and listen to some great sideband audio on that thing. It's really a neat radio. Worth the investment.
Yeah, and I like having the 220. It's not a real popular band, but there's a group on 220 that makes it worthwhile having that capability out there. And the broadband receiver, I use it at air shows to scan, like, the Thunderbirds frequencies and listen to their performances. And the Airboss when I'm working at the Houston air show. Things of that nature. So I use that capability more than the SSB part of it.
Cool. Well, do you work with young people at all, getting people interested in the hobby or involved in some clubs that are trying to help grow the hobby?
The two clubs that I'm most active on down here is the Johnson Space Center Club, W5RRR. And not a lot of youth outreach there in the way of kids, young kids, but we have NASA interns that come through, college age kids that have an opportunity to get licensed while they're here and work at the shack. So we get a lot of people coming through that way and get at least a taste of it that way. The other group is our Brazoria County Aries group. I live in Brazoria County and work in Harris County, so side by side. So that one's more public service oriented, not as much outreach, though some of the people in the club do have the ham crams. The one-day sessions where you go through all the question pool and then do the testing at the end of the day that are very successful, usually having 97-98%+ pass rate on those. And getting their ticket is the start to get in. I mean, that's their license to learn, as we like to tell them. They're not going to come out of that being hotshot operators, but they're going to at least have the tools they need to get started.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I've been hearing from a lot of people, particularly young people, the way to reach the young generation is with what they've got in their pocket. That's the cell phone. And so there are a lot of VoIP services like Zello that, in fact, I've been instrumental in trying to get people involved that aren't licensed in the Skywarn program using Zello. There's a lot of great weather channels there. And then rubbing shoulders with amateur radio operators, they can learn more about the hobby and to get some mentoring and get into groups where they can study together or learn more about how they can get their license. And it's been fairly effective. And I think satellites is another good thing. Seems like kids are interested in space. It's a little bit more intriguing than, you know, sitting in front of a box and trying to, you know, do HF or Morse code and things. And a lot of the digital things seem to attract people too, letting their computers do the work for them, like FT8 and things like that. I'm really into some of the digital technology that's fairly new here. Have you ever heard of DV-Link or DV-Switch?
No, not familiar with that one.
Really? Oh, you'd be fascinated by this. Although maybe you're a purist too. It feels like you have to have a radio, and I know there's a big debate on that. But there's a couple of hams that have put together this platform called DV-Switch, where they do the coding and encoding of the digital modes in software, mostly, except for D-Star. You have to have hardware for that. But like right now, right beside me, I have a Raspberry Pi running a server called DV-Link. You use DV-Switch Mobile as an application on any Android device. So I've got an Android TV box here with my 27-inch flat panel TV running DV-Switch Mobile, and with that I can communicate on any DMR group, D-Star, P25, NXDN, Fusion, without radio. And I can put this on my Android phone or my network radio. But, you know, kids can't afford a lot of this fancy equipment. But things like these technologies, I think if more hams would be open to them and accepting of them, that would be a great way to reach young kids. And I'm part of this group called the YACHT, Young Amateurs Communications Ham Team. They basically all use Echolink on their phone. But now with all this stuff that's been coming out in the last couple of years, it is blowing the doors wide open for kids to get involved without spending a lot of money, but meeting people all over the world and learning about all the different facets of amateur radio. You'll have to check that out. DVLink is the server software that just runs on a Raspberry Pi. It's free. This particular image that I'm using was developed by a guy in Spain and his team. The original images came out only in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, so it was a nightmare for me. But now they've got it set up with a nice menu. You can pick your language, Spanish or English, and go through the menu and set it up in just minutes. And you can even add secondary users to your server, so multiple people could come in and be talking on different DMR networks, different DMR talk groups. It's pretty amazing stuff. So, and that's kind of what we're about too here, is finding ways to reach this younger generation and get them interested in amateur radio. So I'm surprised you hadn't heard of that yet. I guess we're kind of a small group.
I do need have a need for the non-radio ham radio activities, because when I go to Russia, I don't take any of my personal radio gear. It's a lot of question marks. They're a SEPT country, so I'm legal to operate from Russia. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of question marks about taking radios in and out of the country. And I haven't felt like putting my expensive D-74 on the line with taking it into country or not. So I do have two of the dongles, the AMBE dongles, that running Blue DV, I can run D-Star and DMR from my computer. And the newest version that came out has Fusion with that also.
Sure.
So I've done that kind of operating from Russia.
Yep.
So something like that would be very handy. Of course, I've done Echolink, though most of the nets are at 4 or 5 in the morning Moscow time, so it's hard to get into my usual repeater nets, but I've done Echolink also from over there. So those type of operating opportunities are certainly something I have a need for. So I'll look into that DV link and see what it looks like. That's where the Shark hotspot, the new Shark 3, was interesting to me, is that it has the cross-mode capabilities built into it, so you can have just one of the major radios and get into all the systems with it. You don't have to necessarily have 3 HTs like I do to get into it.
Right. Well, you'll be very impressed and pleased with this DV-Link. I mean, you set it up at home on a Raspberry Pi, and you create an account. And from then on, anywhere you've got Wi-Fi or cell coverage on your Android phone, bring up the app, pick whatever mode, whatever reflector, talk group, room, whatever you want to do, and communicate. It is the simplest thing. But you have to be
I can tell I'm going to have to get a Raspberry Pi 4, because I've got – I just set up my one of my 3s. It's got an ADS-B receiver on it. I'm running G-Predict for the satellites. I've got APRS on it. And about 2 or 3 other things. It's kind of my head up display here in the shack, and I'm going to start overwhelming it before too long.
Well, it runs on the Raspberry Pi 4 now, I understand. I'm running my server on a Raspberry Pi 3B, and it works just great. And I'm out in the country. We've got poor internet, but anytime I'm out and about, I just take my RT4 with me, and I can connect and talk to all my buddies and all the different groups just wherever I go. It's pretty slick.
I've got a Pi with the DV Mega in my truck that I can turn on the hotspot on my phone and have connectivity wherever I am driving down the road with that.
Sure.
So I'm not a stranger to Raspberry Pis at all.
No, that seems to be a staple for ham radio these days, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's that's one of the neatest tools that they've come up with, such a powerful computer for such a low input cost to it.
And, right.
They've got it's such an experimenter's platform that we've had so many people come up with some really neat ideas for it.
Neat. Now, you work with the astronauts that are licensed hams, don't you?
I do.
Do they use any digital up there? Do they have internet up there on the international
Internet's
space station?
Available there. It's not connected into the radio systems, though. There's two networks on the station. There's, of course, the one that's really closed. That's the operating parameters for the station, and so you don't really hook into that. They do have a network, the personal network that they can get on just like you do at home, but it's pretty slow, pretty not the best quality, and there hasn't been anybody with that much interest in radio up there to try things like that. I was the deputy for Serena Onan, who came back a year ago in December, and she was quite active in it, and I like to think I had a big piece in that and getting her interested in it, making contacts. But we haven't had a lot of hams up there for a while that have really taken a big interest in the ham radio as ham radio. They do it for the school contacts. We've had a few that do some random contacts. Doug Wheelock's another one I've worked with quite a bit that is quite interested. There's a couple of the new guys coming up that will hopefully fly in the near future that have some interest, but it's more a peripheral interest. They do it for the educational side of it with school contacts, but they're not that interested in ham radio as ham radio.
Sure. Now, there's a whole new radio system that was just put up there. Is it functioning now?
Not functioning yet. It is on board. It has not been installed yet, though.
Will that be around-the-clock APRS-type TNC setup?
Yeah, it should still have the APRS capability to it, and they don't have a console or anything that they can get on and run packet from up there as from console mode, but the APRS should be functional around the clock.
Do you do that with your D-74?
I have. I've tried it before and bounced the signal off or two, but I haven't done it regularly.
Okay. It takes a little bit to figure that out. I get it on my list. It shows up in my list. I hear others coming in on my list, but to actually make a contact, I've had no success so far.
Yeah, you got to set up your pre-programmed statements to make it quicker so you're not typing on the fly. And
right.
It takes some juggling to do it.
Yeah, I've tried that. I'll continue trying. In fact, the other night here, I saw that the ISS was coming overhead, and it was listed twice in my ISS detector. One of them had this big yellow bar. I thought, what is that? I found out that's when it's visible. And I said, hon, come on, let's check it out. It was like shortly after dusk, and bright as day, this big old thing was going across the sky. That was pretty cool.
Oh, it's beautiful to see. It is just a bright, moving object, and it's impressive. It's even more fun when you know the people that are up there.
Yeah, I'll bet. It must be really exciting for you. Well, that's awesome. Well, this has been really fun. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've got some other meetings going on today. But this has been a real privilege having you here. And again, thanks for the contact on AO92.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I need to get on and do some more satellite contacts. It's just something I haven't had time to hit a lot of for a while. Satellite has a little bit of an overhead to me as far as setup and running it. So not quite as easy as just flipping on, checking into your evening net. So.
Right.
With as crazy as things have been with running the missions, now that I'm done with my missions, I can kind of sit back and relax and have a little bit more time to do some of the fun stuff.
And satellites could keep you busy around the clock from looking at my list, and I'm putting a bunch of them in there. A new one was, what is it, AO88? Or have you done that one?
I haven't done that one. Let's see. The Russians have RS-44 that I have not heard yet.
Oh, really?
The satellite, the status board on AMSAT has shown activity, but I've listened to them a couple of times. I haven't heard anything. That's got a big footprint.
I've heard that one's going to be great.
That's great because that one, I just noticed the pass right before we got on here. It was a low pass for me. It was to the west, and I could have worked Alaska and Hawaii if anybody had been on there. So. The worked all states on satellite is a possibility through that one. But, yeah, I have not heard it yet on the couple of passes I've heard.
I've heard guys working it when it's low in the east. They've actually gotten over into Europe.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. And then the Husky Sats up there, haven't had any luck with it yet.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I'm trying that. My next one I want to try hitting is that PO-101 because it just sounded so good the other day, and now I've got my PL tone system worked out, figured out the secret to it, so I can hopefully get into that one next time.
Well, let's see. Usually I get PO-101 coming up here around 3 o'clock. Let's check the list.
I've got an hour and 6 minutes till AOS for that one.
I got an hour
right
and 2 minutes.
Right in the middle of my meeting. We'll have to see if it's busy during the meeting, if I can sneak out on it or not.
I'll be there.
That's the advantage of working from home.
Yeah.
I can just kind of turn 90 degrees. If I turn to the left, I'm in my office. If I turn to the right, I'm in my shack.
Yep. It should be pretty good. It's got pretty high elevation for me, probably for you too. Mine starts in 1 hour, 2 minutes. But I'll be on it. I'll look for you.
Yeah, I've got a 34-degree elevation, and people were working it down to the horizon. So, yeah, it should be good. I'll listen for you.
Yeah, last night I actually did it from horizon to horizon. I kept, because it was quiet, I kept throwing out my calls saying what degree I was at. You know, 15 degrees, 10 degrees, 5 degrees, 3 degrees. I actually got down to 1 degree and could still hear myself.
I heard you. I heard you say that, yeah. And I just couldn't get back into it because of the PL issue.
Oh, you were there listening then yesterday. That's right. Cool.
Yeah, I was listening to it, but the TS-2000 just has a little weirdness on the way you turn on the PL tones, and
sure.
This is the first weird PL tone. Everything's been 67 or 74, so it's
yeah.
been easy, but
yeah.
This one, I finally figured it out.
Wonderful. Have you got a QSL card?
I do.
I will send you one of mine, and we'll do a contact here at PO-101, and
sounds good.
I'm sure you'll sound great. Well, thank you again so much. God bless you. We will listen for you on the birds.
All right, Danny. Sounds good. Thanks for the QSO.
You bet. WD9GET. This is K5DCC Echo Mike 36.
73 from WD9GET Echo Lima 2-9er.
73. Hi, this is Extra Class Amateur Radio Operator, K5DCC. I just upgraded to my extra class last year. You know how I did it? I used HamTest Online. Did you know that HamTest Online is the top-rated study program on eham.net? 97% of reviewers gave them 5 stars. They have more 5-star user reviews than all other study methods combined. And success is guaranteed. If you fail the amateur radio license exam, they will refund your subscription. It's a no-brainer. You pass the exam or get a full refund. Try it for yourself at hamtestonline.com.